I'm Mary Val Landrum, and I am going to be talking to Judy with Mark Lycombe today, which is Thursday, May 19th, 1994. And we are talking in Judy's office at First United Methodist Church in Oberlin, Ohio, where Judy is the pastor. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning.
Could you tell me a little bit about your background, like where and when you were born, and about your family?
I was born in 1954 in Cleveland, Ohio, where my parents still live. They're still living in the family home, as a matter of fact. I was the fourth of six children, four girls and two boys. We are very active in Epworth Euclid Church as a family, and my parents are still there. And I think I mentioned that because church was sort of the hub of our family life in a lot of ways. Very central. Is there something else you want to know?
That's good. Or you could tell about your current family, too.
My current family. That's all interwoven in this ministry journey. Right now, I am married to Michael, who works at Ford Motor Company. And we have two children, Kara, who's in kindergarten, and Aaron, who's in preschool. And those two are 18 months apart in age.
I was just musing on my way over here about the number of people in this study who have grown up in Epworth Euclid Church, which is a pretty high percentage because there's you and Karen McCartney, Mary Tame, Mary and Adele. Mm-hmm. But now let me see. Judy Craig came in as an adult. And I'm not sure about Hallie Christian. I'm going to be talking to her next month. So I think she was, I don't
At
think
least
she
a young
grew.
Adult, I think.
Yeah.
I think explorers.
Probably. Yeah. Yeah.
Entry.
But the ones that actually had parents in the congregation too. It's a pretty high percentage. What are some events that you recall in your decision to go into the ministry? And you can start back as far as you want and go as long as you want.
Well, I am aware that the place of the church in my family's life is foundational, and that this was not a weekend thing, and it wasn't something else that you also do as a family. Church was a part of who we are, and I think that was foundational for me, that all the activities in the life of the church, we expected that we would be there and we would be supporting and a part of, and it was our life. Then very specifically, when I was in high school, I assisted Judy Craig in one of the church camps that when she was the director for the week, and she asked me, just as a volunteer who she knew through youth group at Epworth Euclid, if I would come be a sort of volunteer counselor. And I remember sitting on the patio at Camp Klein in some kind of a small group setting, and I don't remember the content of the discussion except that there was a moment when it was just as if it were just Judy and me sitting there, and she looked at me and said, "You have the qualities for ministry."
That's very interesting, because as I have been talking to people, this has come up repeatedly, that other persons have discerned these gifts and articulated them. And in some cases, it has been very, I guess, delayed. So that the reaction for people who have come into the ministry at a later age, which pretty well involves almost all of the people in this study, it has been sort of a, well, for heaven's sake, why didn't you tell me sooner, you know, kind of thing. Yeah.
Well, as I've articulated my journey in the past, I also am aware that while Judy said that, I never forgot that, and I believed it. I didn't march off from camp that day saying, I am going into the ministry. And I think that's the same thing you're saying. Others call forth these things. We don't always make the decision mm-hmm. right that day. Mm-hmm. But that clearly, I never forgot that, and I believed that. And then, I don't know, shall I go on?
Yes.
Some of my
go on.
Journey in that way. Went on to Allegheny College and was strongly influenced by the chaplain and biblical studies professor, Dr. Donald Hobson, who, as chaplain, was the guide for our ecumenical Christian fellowship, oikumene, which met on Sunday evenings. And he also was the chaplain of our evening worshiping community, but he did not lead that service. He had students who planned and preached for that service, and he served communion. But that, relating to him and his introducing us to both biblical studies and to the social gospel, the social justice issues, was very fundamental to my formation. And Brownie Ketchum, Charles Ketchum, was my advisor as a religion major. And my first class of Christian ethics got me on, sort of gave me the bug of religious studies, and it was his class that made me decide to be a religion major as a sophomore at Allegheny. Both of them I see as role models that showed me that a thinking person who liked to wrestle with questions and issues also could be a religious professional.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the reason I make a distinction, which may be unfortunate, is that there were other models of religious communities at Allegheny in which I didn't feel at home, that were more fundamentalist, and so it was good to have an option that felt right to me.
Yes, yes. And after college?
At the point of graduation, I wanted to use my religion major, but I didn't want to go to graduate school immediately. I was clear that I wanted to support myself, didn't want to go home to mom and dad's. That wasn't what we did in my family. It hadn't been the model of my brothers and sisters. I didn't want to. But I didn't know what you could do using a religion major without any graduate
school. That's still a problem, I think.
And one of the speakers that came to our ecumenical Christian fellowship was a US-2 domestic missioner through the Board of Global Ministries National Division. And he came and told us about the US-2 program, and I applied and was accepted and was hired by an ecumenical group in Mansfield, Pennsylvania, coalition of 5 Protestant churches, had an advisory board and hired me to come provide campus ministry at Mansfield State College. So I went there and worked with a Roman Catholic nun in a team at the college developing campus ministry. And every year I took out seminary catalogs and looked at them again and always had the feeling that I would go to seminary. If I said I wouldn't go to seminary, that God would put me in seminary. I just had a strange feeling about that, but that it was okay to wait for the right time. And I would look at catalogs and decide again, is it time, is it not time? And continued in campus ministry in Mansfield for 2.5 years. And in January of 1979, I was hungry to come back to the city and had conversations with Bill McCartney about coming to Epworth Euclid to work in outreach and campus ministry. So I did that.
And 1979 was when you came back to Epworth Euclid?
Yeah. The early part of 79. And then I worked in that capacity of lay ministry at Epworth Euclid until the winter of 1981, December of 1981, when I went to seminary.
Mm-hmm. And where was that?
I went to Garrett Evangelical Seminary in Evanston, Illinois. I want to say something, too, about that decision. When I first came out of college and very excited and interested in intellectual endeavors, I looked at seminaries that I thought had a very high intellectual reputation. I don't know if I'm
right.
Clear about that.
Oh, yes, I know what you mean, exactly.
And I, by the time that I had worked in the Huff area for a couple years and in a rural area of Mansfield, Pennsylvania, and with college students, I became, and probably the reason I went on for further education was that I was immersed in the practical sphere and felt that I needed more skills in order to be of some help to anyone in ministry. And while I don't think I ever gave up on the importance of theological dialogue and all that, I went to seminary looking for some practical help for people because I felt I was not, other than being a kind listener, I didn't feel I had much to offer. No, that doesn't sound right. I needed more help, wanted to have more skills. So, and really felt a clear call that it was time to go to seminary sometime in 1981. And then I pursued the application process. But went to Garrett particularly because I liked the way that I thought that they lived out what they said they stood for. They had three emphases, Peace and Justice Institute, Church, Women in the Church, and Church in the Black Experience were their three priorities. And they lived out their priorities not only in the courses they offered, but also the hiring of faculty. They had more women faculty and more minority faculty than the other seminaries. And I liked the fact that they seemed to live out what they said were priorities. And so I went out there.
I think that's very, very important, not only for a seminary to have a clear vision, but also to live it out. I'm so fascinated with the newsletter, alumni magazine that I get from Union Seminary in New York City. And to see how they have, I think, really kept pace with the changing world, which is very different from 1960 when we were there. And I mean, they're really, I think, out in the forefront of this. And essentially they have to be, because there they are in the center of Manhattan. I mean, to do anything else would be putting on blinders, I think. But it's just really interesting to see what they do and who's on their faculty and how they deal with the issues of the day, which is crucial. And I think that word, I'm very careful when I use the word crucial, knowing what its etymology is.
Yeah. So, good.
Well, so what, I've already talked about some persons who have been important to you. Are there other people that you recall that were really important in your decision? And I realize that this was a series of decisions.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm aware, as I talk to other women in ministry, that I am appreciative of my parents' support a lot of people, I kind of took it for granted because I was raised understanding that a woman or a man could do anything they wanted to. But I realized afterwards by people asking me, what did your parents think? Oh my goodness, my parents are right there cheering me along.
Yeah.
And I know that was very important, but it was part of who they were that I did take it for granted that, oh, of course they would be excited about that. Let me think if there are others. I hate to run the tape.
No. Wait, I've got lots of tape.
Again, I think that they were so much a part of my experience that maybe I don't readily think of them as standing out, but I am sure that the community of Epworth Euclid also, from the very start, from Sunday school years, were behind me as much as any individual, and that particularly when I came back and was in the profession of ministry, first as a layperson, I got lots of support from them, both for my position then and also for my decision for ordination, which continued then when I came back in a pastoral role there. Really, those that I've mentioned are the people that stand out primarily as folks that shaped my decision to go into ministry.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I have noticed about the way Epworth Euclid treats its children and youth, and treats is not probably a good word, but it is that they deal with them with such respect as individuals that they look and see what their talents are and offer them opportunities to operate within the framework of the church using their talents as individuals. Not, oh, this is a nice little thing that the youth can do today, but here's a person. And I think that's really wonderful. I wish that there were more churches that were able to do that. And not just, perhaps not just the children and youth, but all individuals. Oh, this is not UMW Sunday, so we'll let the women do. But here's an individual who has, who can be a liturgist or read the scriptures well or whatever, and let them do it.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And here again, my being in it, I didn't know how unusual it was, and I came out and expected the same thing in other places, and realize now how Epworth Euclid does that, and that is a wonderful quality that Epworth Euclid has to try to involve people, because it's important to me. It requires a whole education process that at other churches, that this
yes.
is not the minister's job only, and that liturgy is work of the people, and that it that somehow I'm not trying to get out of my responsibilities by having others involved in leading worship in various capacities or other leadership too.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't see that. I just took it for granted that's the way churches were, and it is. It's a wonderful quality that may not be unique to Upper Euclid, but is not found everywhere.
That's right. That's right. Well, I've been on this big thing about the ministry of the laity for quite a while now, and you are so right. It is not universal at all.
Well, the first time I heard here, just through the grapevine, not directly, that I was being paid to lead the service, and somebody understanding that I was trying to get out of work by having lay readers or liturgists, and it was pretty funny to me, because it, of course, is more work to involve
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
But anyway,
yeah, a lot of times I'm sure that that's why the pastor does it all, because it's easier, you know. You don't have to plan ahead.
Right.
You can just go in there and do it. But, well, let's pursue then the rest of your career that got you to where you are right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know there's been other things between when you graduated from seminary and now.
Mm-hmm.
So what was in the intervening years there? Where did you serve? And
okay. Well, if I can back into seminary just a little
sure.
bit. When I went to seminary, as I said, I was looking for skills to help people and thought of myself at that time as preparing probably for counseling, some kind of counseling role, because I did not see myself as an evangelist and a group rallying person. I didn't see myself as a preacher. I did know of skills on one-to-one and in small group because I'd been doing campus ministry. Found out when I was in seminary and I had an opportunity to serve preaching for a whole summer while a pastor was on leave, that I was a preacher. It was kind of a surprise to me. And that I loved preaching. And at that point, I became more comfortable with the idea of becoming appointed to be pastor of a church. So at the time that I left seminary, I did accept appointment to be associate pastor at Brunswick United Methodist Church, which is a church of 1,000 members, suburban community. Part of the role, the responsibility of the associate pastor was to administrator of the education ministries. And I was very glad that we had a lot of teachers in our congregation because they knew a lot more about education than I did in Christian education. I could provide the Christian aspect, and they knew a lot about writing scope and sequence and things like that and planning for the education. And it was a nice cooperative, very good ministry. We had a youth group of 150, active about 70 every week, and it was there again. That doesn't happen everywhere. It was
no.
exciting,
yes.
very exciting place to be. Had a youth Sunday that would have been missed by the adults as well as the youth if we didn't have it each week, and still did not do the job that I think Everett Euclid does at having that not be just a special Sunday, but to involve youth in ways all through, although we had acolytes. Anyhow, I was at Brunswick for 4 years, and the last, and part of that time I was the only pastor because we went through a transition of mm-hmm. senior pastors. While I was the only pastor, I was in my 9th month of pregnancy with my first child, and then went on maternity leave just as the new senior pastor came, and stayed at Brunswick for 6 months with this child in the library, a playpen, or home with Mike, who worked a different shift, and decided that I needed to be with her full time because I didn't want to make decisions between someone else's child who was ill and my child who was ill. I
yes.
wanted to be with my child if she were ill, and was very torn at that time. I can remember crying in the interview with the committee to go on leave of absence, just crying because I was so filled with emotion about this decision.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But very clear that I wanted to be on leave and to be with her, and the committee was very, very gracious about that. So we left Brunswick after I had been there 4 years with our 6-month-old daughter and bought a house in Cleveland Heights and went back to Upper Euclid where I sang in the choir and taught Sunday school and had a great time.
And then?
And then in 1990, I went to Upper Euclid in July of 1988. In spring of 1990, I served an interim stint at Fairview Grace when their pastor left, Robert Remington left, for a seminary position. I don't know if you want any of these women anecdotes in here. Or
sure,
not.
Of course.
All I know, Fairview Grace was very concerned about getting up their first woman. And I have, I planted by Judy Craig, I have in my mind this confidence I have in my ministry. I have never been afraid to go into a situation and be someone's first woman, not only because of what she said to me, but because of what she did at Epworth Euclid. And I don't know, I wasn't in the circles that might have heard, well, of course, she came in as a Christian educator, and that was acceptable for a woman to be. And then she moved on up as she would because of her gifts to be associate pastor there. But ever since then, I have gone into situations as a first woman and have never been afraid of that. I have always felt, well, just hire me.
Yes.
And then you'll be all right, you'll see.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been wonderful freedom. And that's what happened at Fairview Grace. It was interesting at the interview that there was an assumption that I would not have child care. They didn't even express it as a concern. They just said, well, they wondered how I would get emergency calls while I was home in Cleveland Heights with my child. They didn't assume I would be at Fairview Grace at the church in the office kind of thing. And I said, oh, no, I have child care arranged. At that time, I think I had two children at that point, as AJ was born in 89. So anyway, I had a wonderful time at Fairview Grace, and I've had this experience many times. That one man came into the office toward the end of my three-month interim with his hat in his hand and his head bowed and said, I didn't want you to come here, but now I'm glad you're here. And I've run into that many times, where people have a need to confess this. I haven't asked
That's
them
interesting.
To, but
yeah.
They have a need to come tell me that they didn't want me, uh-huh. But that they have learned otherwise, and that's been great. And that same fellow has come out here to visit, and it's interesting to me how many of the visitors I have from former churches are older men, because that was a group that I felt most intimidated by, just not by because of them, but because of me, and I don't know what all those issues are, but those seem to be a lot of the people that responded to my ministry,
mm-hmm.
and have continued to be in touch, mm-hmm. with me after, mm-hmm. I've gone. Folks, I'd say my father's age.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I sort of fell into a little girl feeling myself in those relationships. I'm sort of past that now. I think I grew out of that with experience.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember especially my first appointments feeling very intimidated and young in relationship with men my father's age in the churches.
Well, it just, I think that's just one example of all of the layers of relationships that go on between people, that it's not just a role over here, and that you slip into it at all times. You're not just the pastor, you're also a mother, and you're not just a mother to your own children, but that mother comes out at other times when it's called forth by people who need it, as well as, you know, the preacher, the theologian, the whatever, the gardener, the cook. And when people like that man who came to you begin to stop labeling and boxing people and start looking at them as individuals, then I think that's a terrific breakthrough. But I think it's something that we, particularly as women, are never going to get over. We have not won the battle. We just haven't. And there's still so much discrimination and it's so subtle, and sometimes not so subtle.
Mm-hmm.
I always just remember Brian Wren, you know, was at our church just a couple of weeks ago. He's such a wonderful person. And I had a confession to make to him about his book, What Language Shall We Borrow, which is a wonderful Wonderful book. I told him, I said, I had to keep stop reading it because I'd get so angry. Not at what he was saying, but at what men had done to women over the years. And so before he stayed at my house, and before I left, I said, do you want to do the author thing? And he said, oh, sure. So I handed him the book so he could sign it. And so he stood there for quite a long time thinking. And I thought, oh, boy, what's he going to write? You know. And so finally, after he had left, I got up my courage and looked at the title page. And he had said up at the top, you know, to Mary Bell from Brian or something, the date. And then down below the title, he put, don't get mad, get moving.
Get moving.
Yes. I thought that was cute. So, I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's all right. I remember where I was. A year after my Fairview Grace experience, Robert, I think it was Bob Miller at Epworth Euclid, the associate, retired to California. And Phil Gillis, who was the senior minister at the time, asked me if I would like to work part-time. Bob's position had been part-time. And I was dying to go back to work, which I found out at Fairview Grace. I didn't realize I was unhappy at home without working, but as soon as I went to Fairview Grace, I got so happy, so full of joy. So I said, yes, I would like to work at Epworth Euclid, and that was approved by the proper authorities. And so I worked part-time starting in 91, and in about a year later, in the fall of 92, Phil Gillis took another job with Flat Rock Home, and the district superintendent and the cabinet, or the bishop, decided that they would ask me to stay for the last 6 months of 1990, or first 6 months of 93, finishing the conference year as the pastor at Epworth Euclid. So, and that was a ball. I had a great time.
Yes, yes, and they loved having you. Well, now, Judy, it seems to me that I see a pattern here now.
I do little pieces of things.
Three times you have served as an interim pastor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what are you going to do here? You're the only one, aren't you?
That's right. Now I'm at Oberlin. I feel like somehow I was backed into being full-time and into being a pastor of the church. And I don't see this as an interim, although several times I have gone into crisis situations, not just with a pastor leaving, but several times in a situation where there was a lot of unrest in the congregation. And I really do see that as sort of my thing to do, to go in and to be a pastor in troubled situations and so that they can be restored.
A healer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, and goodness knows we need it. Yes. That's something that I have mused on quite a lot, which is how do you heal sick congregations? And because there are a lot of them. And I've decided that one of the things that we don't deal with in the church is the anger and grief that is within a congregation. For instance, when there is a troubled pastorate, or when a pastor dies, when just when a pastor leaves in the normal course of appointments,
yes.
I don't think that we deal with the anger and grief that's left there, which is very real.
I don't know that we can, with our polity, whether we can do something like what the United Church of Christ does, but I know that they have a year interim between mm-hmm. pastorates, and it makes a lot of sense.
Yes, yes.
Because well, those motions aren't generally directed at the interim pastor because the church knows now, they know how this works and that this person is coming in to serve for a short time. That's how I felt at Fairview Grace. I think if they had, Bob Remington was very popular, And I think if they had thought that I was the new pastor, I think I would have had a harder time.
That's very possible.
And, but because they knew I was short term, they went with the program, and it turned out very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
It was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I know the same thing happened here. Daryl was very loved, and the person to follow Daryl had a very hard time.
Right. And as pastor, it's tend to lengthen within the United Methodist Church. Then you find that happening more and more, where a pastor goes in who is following someone who's been there for 25 years, or even 10 years, which is, I mean, that's good. I think a 10-year pastorate is good. But the person who follows them has all kinds of stuff to deal with. I knew a man in the UCC church who, that was all he did, was interim pastorates. And as he talked about it, I thought, we really need something like that, I think, in the United Methodist Church. We do interim pastorates, only we don't know that's what we're doing.
That's right.
And so we have these little sacrificial lambs that go in and get crucified, which is so sad.
Yes, it is.
It's not good for the congregation. It's certainly not good for the pastors.
No. There's something, well, there's a lot about that interim pastorate idea that appeals to me. I would like to be one of those. I don't know what that says about me, but I guess because I have done some of that,
right.
And I like that. Well, somehow it's, I don't know, it's just, it's easier to love people. I receive love too, but it's easy to love people for me. I don't know. I don't know if the long haul is harder.
Do you think you maybe set up barriers, like to try? This is just kind of off the top of my head. That to protect yourself, like if I go into a situation where, these are people that I know that I'm going to live with for maybe the rest of my life, I really watch what I say. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm very careful about, until I know whether they really want, whether they can handle the real Mary Bell Landrum or not, you know?
Yes.
And that's one reason I love my Sunday school class so much, because we're the radical fringe of Christ United Methodist Church, and I can go in there and talk about anything with them, which I can't do with other groups in that church. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could, but I'm not willing to risk it. So I can see what you're saying. There's a freedom.
Yes.
To be yourself.
Right. That's it. That's it. Yep. You said it. And that, I would love to keep, and I am working on that for my every parish. And that's one of my chief prayer concerns right now in terms of my own vocation is to have that freedom. I was thinking the other day about Bishop Thomas when he ordained us and said, take the authority. You're ordained outside of the parish, not in the parish,
yes.
And you have the authority now. You're free. You're free. Of course, there's a tremendous responsibility to that freedom. I'm not saying there isn't, and you know that about
yes.
me. But not to get so hung up about, what do I say this, and what if somebody thinks that, and I'm so sick of that.
Yes.
I'm so sick of that. And that's what keeps, if I become unhappy, it's because I'm listening too much to that kind of stuff and not taking the authority and that has been entrusted because I have supposedly the gifts to not abuse that authority.
Yeah, yeah.
And the judgment.
I spoke at the Ashland Seminary Chapel a couple of weeks ago, and I was so conscious of every word that I was saying. Well, because I knew what kind of a community I was going into. But actually, and I thought some of the things I said were rather daring for that community, but as a matter of fact, it was very well received. And so I thought, well, the next they want me to come back. So maybe the next time I'll open up a little bit more, you know. Yeah, it's an intriguing thoughts about all the different people we are and who we let see which person. Well, when you think back over your years in church, it's pretty scary, isn't it? When you count up the number of Sundays you've been in church.
Oh, I've never even thought that, taking on that exercise.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. When it makes taking a Sunday off and staying home, which I do once about every 5 years, I think, oh, that's as good as a month's vacation. You really, just the change. You feel so naughty. But do you remember any worship services or liturgies in particular that influenced you on your road to ministry? Or a whole pattern of or way of worship. Of course, you know, liturgy is one of my interests, and so I'm just kind of throwing these questions in there to see if I can pick up any kind of a pattern.
Well, I think very clearly that the amount of liturgy that Epworth Euclid has is clearly in me in terms of how I plan liturgy, and I'm always surprised when people come here, which is so much less high church than I even picture Epworth Euclid, and say, oh, this is very high church, you know, Methodist. I guess maybe it is. I haven't been to too many real free style. Or any, except maybe as an occasional visitor, but not any. I haven't served any that weren't kind of liturgical United Methodist churches, but I know that I have a bias that way, and because of Epworth Euclid. I thought that our chapel services at college were very formative to me, to both my faith and to my call, and that was again participation by everybody there at one time or another. Different people were the speaker, and different people, and those that were speaking planned the service. Although we did have a formula, I mean, we did have a liturgy mm-hmm. that we followed, but there was room for variation in that. And that I remember that the communion was at a table in front, where we came up in groups and knelt with the chaplain, and he gave us an opportunity also to one of us would serve him each Sunday as a part of that. It was a sense of community, and more than liturgy, I think what is so important to me is that it's not a spectator sport.
Yes,
It's not something we come to and watch you do it, and then we go home and feel a little better. You know, we need to come together and worship so that we can go out and continue doing what we think we're supposed to do. And that's the I'm trying to decide whether now it's time to give my people a chance to hear something else from the pulpit, because I am convinced that what this congregation and so many others need is to understand themselves as a community, and this congregation does not. and I'm afraid they might feel hammered on because that's always my theme. And I don't know exactly how we grow that, but we're trying in a variety of ways. But that, I don't know if that answers your question at all. But
oh, yes,
again,
it does.
It's a participation of all of us because we all need it. And I'm more than willing to lead that. I love it. It's my favorite part of my job. Not the counseling that I thought would be, but to lead worship and to preach. So I'm happy to do that, but I am not going to go do it alone.
Right.
No point
to me in
my doing it alone and having somebody watch and file out.
Yeah. You said almost what I expected you to say, which was that having grown up within the liturgy of Upworth Euclid Church, we tend not to realize that there's other ways to do it. I can remember when Bob Miller came to Epworth Euclid, and I was writing the liturgy at that point because, of course, he came after John died. And he would say to me, time after time after the service, I never knew that worship could be this way, where all the parts fit together. He says, the way you take the scriptures and pick out the hymns to go with it, you know, and the anthems and the sermon all fit together. It was a revelation to him.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, that surprises me. It surprised me to hear that from a clergy member, but I have experienced that in each church I've gone to. People come up and maybe they haven't even heard it for the first 9 months, and all of a sudden they'll say, the scripture went with the hymn. I've been helped and learned, I think by seeing others that did it, sometimes to have a sentence at the beginning of the service to meditate on, it helps people know that this is where we're going today. So that then they're helped to see how it comes together. I like to have it be obvious or sort of be internal or absorbed by osmosis or something, but I also want people to know, to notice if they're not going to notice otherwise, so that they can get the point.
Right.
Of the day.
Right. Well, I know that Christ, oftentimes the opening prayer or whatever they call it, it picks up phrases from the scriptures, the lectionary. And I often think, now, I wonder how many people in the congregation recognize. Because I spend the whole week with the lectionary. And if I get to church on Sunday and find that the preacher isn't preaching on the lectionary, I'm really miffed. Because it means so much more to me to have some background in the scriptures. Before we get to Sunday, because just reading him through once, or just hearing it, and it always happens that when they're reading the scriptures on Sunday morning, I'll hear something that even though I've read it all week, I didn't notice, which is humbling, but very good, yeah.
That's why we're not done with them yet.
Oh, gosh, isn't it true? Isn't it the truth? Oh, we went back to Epworth Euclid a few weeks ago. Hadn't been there since I left to worship, so I hadn't been there for 2 years, 2.5 years. And it was just like coming home, I tell you. I thought there. Oh, wow, this is wonderful, you know. The music was so good, and the state, I mean, the place is so gorgeous. I sat there and soaked it up, just soaked it up. And felt renewed in a way that I try to express to people when I'm teaching them about creativity and spirituality, that we're not talking about frills here. This is gut level that we need, just like we need milk, coffee, whatever. We need this beauty. The Puritans had it all wrong. not just in that, but now let's look if we can. We've already talked about some of these things, but if you were to try to analyze what it was about the Upper Euclid community that enabled, encouraged, empowered you, can you pull out some of those things?
Well, I know that there are a lot of strong women in leadership and have always been there. I don't want to classify it as a matriarchy, really, because I don't think that men seemed less visible or less strong in comparison. I just think it's been a model of women and men together leading the church. And there again, I get out of there and I think that's the way the world is. And I think it's been just, I feel so dumb, but I've just been very naive. In some ways, I think I've offended some of my clergy sisters in some circles because I haven't taken on the battle, and in some ways I've not even wanted to deal with the battle because I've been someplace where it works, and I don't want to crush all men in the process either.
Right.
I've been someplace where we've been together, and so I'm not a very good spokesperson or advocate for the cause of decrying all the things that have been done to us, and because that wasn't my experience, and hasn't been in the local church either, frankly, in a way that stopped me. But I know that shows that I've been in some fortunate situation. But it is because of my attitude that came out of Upper Euclid. Well, you're going to tell me I can't be the minister here? Well, of course I can. Well, of course I can, you'll see. And then we'll be all right.
That's right.
It doesn't even touch me. It doesn't hurt me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because they're wrong.
Yes.
I've
yes.
seen it the other way. Yeah. So it's just, I know that, and I can't, it's hard for me to be specific, I guess, because I've just been in it all my life.
Wow. Yes,
and
well,
I assume that that's the way it should be, and that's, I don't know.
Well, that's a very empowering thing, and that's a very, I think, I see that as a very positive approach to feminism, which for me I think advances the cause much better than the negative stuff, which, you know, I don't want to eliminate all the men, I want to work with them. And the other piece of that I think out of Epworth Euclid was not just a gender thing, but was also a racial thing. That there, it was people as individuals. I mean,
right.
I have never experienced a congregation that was so diverse. Mm-hmm. In every way, from wealth to poverty, from education to, you know, not non-educated, uneducated, mm-hmm. From the brilliantly gifted to the mentally disabled. I mean, it was just incredible.
Yeah.
I used to love World Communion Sunday because we could muster people from all over the world just in the congregation.
Yes.
It was, and I understand that probably in a place, for instance, like Ashland, the diversity is, the resources for diversity are more limited. Although, you know, when I look at it, it's not really true. Because we have Koreans and Indians and, you know, there in the, and the university is there. And, but.
It has to be a community that where people want to come.
That's right.
That's what I'm working on
here. Yeah. That are welcoming to those who are different.
Yeah.
Of course, my opinion is we're all different. What do you mean?
Right.
I don't know how you do it, though.
I don't either.
Because you can be sure that Epworth Euclid wasn't always that way. I mean,
right.
Sure, that back in its heyday, in the 50s, when they would muster however many 2,000 people on Easter Sunday morning, maybe it wasn't that many. A lot, though. I'll bet it was pretty white.
Oh, yeah. Oh. The tape recorder running. But I think there are ways of assuring that that was the case.
Oh, I'm sure.
People,
yeah.
That steered people to down to Corey.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I haven't done any study on this, but I'm quite sure that Bill McCartney's pastorate was the point of opening up, and people that comprise the kind of atmosphere we see there now. Coming because of what his priorities were and the content of his preaching, and then Judy coming. Well, Judy was there, and her ministry of tapping people on the shoulder and saying, I see that you have these qualities. Would you do this?
Mm-hmm.
I keep, my mom keeps saying, well, Judy Craig could do that. You have to be like Judy Craig. And I keep saying, I'm not Judy Craig.
Well, you're Judy Clycombe, and that's very good.
I have some skills, but I can't do it as readily as she seemed to be able to do it, but that I know that it's needed, and that is not just to assume that people will step forward and say, here am I, send me, but that you have to say, I see this in you, will you come on and do this, and just bringing people into the picture.
Yeah, and there was another ministry in that congregation, which your mother still is, I think, the prime example of it, and that is to spot an unfamiliar face. Mm-hmm. And I can see her linking her arm with the person who showed up for the first time and walking them into the church and saying, you know, you come and sit with me. And that's a lot of what it takes, too. And I know other people, like from Case Western Reserve, who would latch onto new people that came into town and say, come to our church. Mm-hmm. That's the ministry of the laity with a vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if that's something that you can teach. You can model it, certainly. I don't know. Well, it's good to know that our work isn't all done, isn't it? Do you think that the actual geographic location of Epworth Euclid has had some influence on you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. And I think another piece that came together in a way that was very satisfying to me is in the last several years anyway, when we started having more ministry in our geographical location. I've always been very proud to be sitting in the city. I've always been concerned about populations of the city to which we were not ministering, and for a variety of all kinds of understandable reasons, I'm sure. But to have the daycare center there now, that has, again, a diverse population, both the children of professionals that work in the area and also folks, presumably, who are receiving child care assistance, and all kinds of folks. And then there again, the little United Nations that's represented in that daycare center is something to see. And the neighborhood lunch program. there's so many ministries there, which I'm so proud. And a lot of them started after I was doing supposedly doing outreach work, and I had nothing to do with their starting. But I'm so happy to see.
Well, at least you didn't stop them.
No. Well, I like to think that maybe some of the door opening that we started earlier helped there to be a way for these programs to come in. Because I can remember when we had to talk about whether neighborhood youth could come in and play basketball, or.
Mm-hmm.
Or whether we would have to have a vault that could be secured before we could let anyone come in.
Mm-hmm.
What stairs people could use, and mm-hmm. whether we needed electric eyes and all kinds of things, and whether there'd be graffiti on the wall, and all these questions that came up about protecting our museum, our beautiful, beautiful building, but the fear that would somehow be gone if we opened up to outreach programs. So, and we did pry the doors open and had our share of thefts and all kinds of things
that
we may
yes.
not have had otherwise, but I think we would. Anyhow, and now there are some ongoing ministries, which I'm very proud of. That's that other piece that maybe wasn't there before. Although we always had people that were great benefactors of mission ministry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we'll have some hands-on stuff too. I still say we. I keep hoping I don't use the possessive pronoun when I'm here at this church all the time. I'll say, well, epithetically, we do this and we do that.
Yeah, but I think that's a real sort of a marker as to the kind of place it is.
Mm-hmm. It's like Jerusalem to me.
Even though I'm gone, I'm still a part of that.
Yeah.
Which I've never felt that way. I don't think about any other church. Still have friends there, at other churches,
mm-hmm.
but don't feel. I still feel a part of that congregation. Which I think is wonderful, and I'm grateful that I was able to be a part of it.
Yeah, I can remember when I started in outreach in '79, having conversations in McDonald's, which was then at 107th and Euclid, and learning that our church was perceived as a closed
mm-hmm.
community. I mean, a place where people from somewhere else come in and close the doors, and you can't come in. And I didn't perceive us that way, and I knew that we intended and wanted to be open and inviting, and I knew that we didn't steer people away to other churches anymore, if they ever did that, but that was the neighborhood perception, that it was not for people of the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly some people would not have been comfortable there, but that was their issue. But at the same time, I knew that if there is this perception, we have a responsibility to be more inviting.
Well, I know that there were people who would come in off the street, and there was a remarkable number of those tourists who would come in and would be amazed that we actually worshipped there.
Right.
This isn't a museum.
Right. Yeah.
And I suppose that's because of the building, which has so many similarities to the great European cathedrals,
right.
at where you go and sometimes they're amazed that, oh, people do worship here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think one of the great things they did was that open house a couple years back. I think that was when Phil was there.
Uh-huh.
Inevitably, when people do visit, or if you point out the church to them and they haven't been there, they'll say, oh, I always wanted to go to that. I always wanted to try that church. I always wanted to visit, and to send out an invitation to say, you've always wanted to come. This is open house. I thought that was a great idea. We had a wonderful turnout there.
Yeah, great. No commitments. Just come
that's
and
right.
look at the place. Yeah. That's wonderful to be able to do that. what is it somebody called it? Building evangelism.
Hmm.
But mm-hmm. this is, and that was something I heard too, was that every year you should do something to the outside of your building that people can see when they go by, whether it plant a tree, you know, put up a sign, paint, you know, but to do something to the outside of your building that this attracts people's attention. And I thought, it's probably true that it's this maintenance of the building is as important as what? Feeding the hungry, I guess. Because if you can't get the hungry to come, then you're not going to feed them. Well, let's look at the negative for a minute here. What was it discouraged you on your vocational quest? Don't tell me you were never discouraged. I won't believe you.
My vocational quest, what discouraged me? I wasn't sure I wanted to be around religious people. No, I do think.
I know the church can be very discouraging at times.
But I had a model. Again, I needed to know that I could be real, that I could be real, and maybe popular images of clergy showed stuffed shirt, uptight, moralistic, mean people. That I didn't want to be one of those, but I think that's more media than the reality, actually, now that I'm in the community of clergy. But I knew I didn't want to be that. I also, I want to get positive here, but I think our denomination and the tolerance that in the past we have exhibited for a variety of theological perspectives is something I appreciate, because I couldn't be, I don't think I could be in a church where the precise creeds were dictated.
Mm-hmm.
I have too much respect for human beings and how God would like to work with them individually. What discouraged me? Well, now, I think I mentioned a little before, I think it's the same thing. And to not be able to be to be free or authentic because I'm in a position where a lot of people think that they should define or have an idea of who I ought to be, that the lack of freedom, and I don't mean license, but I just mean
no, I know what you mean. Freedom, exactly.
Is a strain. It is discouraging, but I think it's something that I really believe that it has a lot to do with my spiritual life and my work otherwise on myself, that I can come to an acceptance of authorities that are within and in terms of my relationship with God, and not rely so much on these other authorities that I let dictate who I should be and make me feel.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of jargon, but I'm feeling freer for preaching, for example, and a lot of other things. I can't be shut up in my preaching because I'm worried about what somebody's going to think about how I've approached the gospel, and I trust that I'm doing that with proper study and authenticity and kindness, and so I need to trust that and go on and not be worried about it. I preached on AIDS first time the other day, not on AIDS. I preached about are we ready, because now we have our first families with AIDS in the family in our church, and these families need us to be a Christian community for them, and gave a story, not in our church, but a story from outside of our church of a woman who was virtually shut out of her church of her lifetime after her two brothers died of AIDS. And people were mad. People were mad at me afterwards for broaching the subject. I think I didn't follow up with mm-hmm. with them, the ones I perceived to be mad, but had to be preached.
Oh, yes.
So we got to get ready.
Gosh.
We're here.
That's right.
So.
That's right. Well, and I always think of Wesley when we get into situations like this and think, wouldn't have stopped Wesley. He would have gotten up there and said, I'm sure, much of what you had said, and dodged the stones. We got to do it. Not only because we're Christians, but doggone it, because we're Methodists. With that background of social action. Yeah. And I wouldn't have it any other way. No.
I don't. I think the things of the job, when I don't take a day off or I don't get enough rest and things like that, those that's just because of those things. I've had one drunk guy one time in Fenway Manor come up and say he didn't believe in me, you know. That just doesn't really faze me. You know, there haven't been blockades to my vocation. Because I always want to say, I think it was, what was her name? Sylvia Hines, who used to be in our conference, who used to talk about, don't tell me, but take it up with the one who called me. If you got a problem with my being in ministry, don't ask me. Take it up with the one who called me. That's just how I feel.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know that you have had struggles with balancing your family life and your call along the way, and a lot of that, as at least my perception of my own life as I've tried to balance family and vocation, has been the time takes care of a lot of these things. That perhaps my own expectations of what I can do at any given time are out of sync. That if I just wait for a while, that will come. And I've witnessed your struggle with some of these things too, and find that you've done a pretty good job of handling it all.
I get, I think it's been, the model has been helpful to some others. I've had positive feedback about, from Barbara Silversmith is one who has told me that she thinks I do a good job of saying no to some things and putting mm-hmm. off some things and not mm-hmm. trying to do it all at once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because those children are first priority, as far as I'm concerned. Always have been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I don't... It's so obvious to me, because I'm in a caring profession, I don't want at some point for them to feel like I went and cared for everybody else's
yes.
children and didn't care for my own.
Yeah.
And of course they're going to want all of it, all of
right.
me. And we have to help them understand that too. But now we are enjoying, Mike's now on day shift for the first time in 17 years.
Oh my.
And we have a family again. And now we're able to share a lot more than we could mm-hmm. when he was on evenings and really wasn't a part of our family life,
mm-hmm.
my life with the kids. And so now we trade off, and it's a lot easier and really,
mm-hmm.
really wonderful for them. So I feel like they're getting more now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's good.
Us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's great.
It's a pretty happy time.
Well, I think one of the benefits that Parsonage children have is the extended family that they've got in the church. This is a wonderful bonus, I think. I know I've seen in our own children, they grow up being able to meet strangers with grace and manners, hopefully.
Oh, good. I'm still looking forward to that day.
It comes. Which I think other children just don't have the opportunities that... at least I look at them as opportunities, maybe some people don't, to meet all these different people and have caring, nurturing people who, because you can't deny it. People look at the pastor's children in a different way, mm-hmm. especially when they're misbehaving. Of course, mine never did. What would, if you were going to suggest something or for the local church to do to encourage ministerial vocations, if you wanted to try to get your congregation in some kind of a, I don't even want to say program, what would you suggest? What can the local church do to encourage ministerial vocations?
Well, I think I come back again to the involvement in worship leadership. I'm sure that was important to me and to those young people that I talk to now that are interested in ministry. They not only are very willing to be involved in leadership, but they find it to be very fulfilling, I think. And mm-hmm. that sort of sets off the bell in their own heads, I think, that, you know, that, okay. that felt right.
Yeah.
And to be, this is all very individual, but to be able to be people who reinforce the gifts. I keep coming back to Judy Craig's statement that mm-hmm. to be able to call forth, you have this. Mm-hmm. This is what we need in ministry. And I do this with people, even the college students that are going into chemistry or something
right.
else. I'll say, you have this gift
mm-hmm.
for ministry. And then if they, and some of them have thought about ministry and for one reason or another are making another decision now. And I just say, well, if you're going that way, you'll end up there, so it's okay. This mm-hmm. is the path right
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
And again, that's very individual, but I think having people participate in the work of the church and calling forth their talents and putting them into roles is probably the best way that the church does that. I think encouraging a camping program, I think church camping is has something to do with that. I mean, helps people in their own mm-hmm. spiritual formation and understanding their being a part of this movement, and that a lot of times leadership emerges from that. I'm sure that was formative for me. I don't think it hurts to have, I've seen some very good, my friend Donna Rost at the Episcopal Church calls catechumenate programs, but small groups that, where they to a little more intensive work at understanding their part in being mm-hmm. the church.
Mm-hmm.
So I always think of small groups or classes that we could have, or small groups that we could have. But
I think all of those are very important.
Nothing very new. They're different, but the things that I think worked in my case, in the case of others that I know.
And one thing that I have become very humbly aware of is that we don't know what the smallest thing that we ask people to do, how it will influence them. I can remember at annual conference one point, I can't even remember what the service was, but a number of different people stood up and said what coming to annual conference meant to them. And there was like a 15-year-old girl who said how much being able to carry the Bible in the procession for the opening service meant to her. And I thought, we're so casual about this stuff.
Yeah.
George Hart, you know George?
Yeah.
What a rebellious teenager he was. Mm-hmm. I can remember introducing him to somebody at the church one time, and I don't even remember who it was that I was introducing him to. And I can't remember what I said about him. He played bells or something, and he said, "And don't forget that I carry the cross on Sunday morning."
Yes.
And I thought, I am corrected. Thank you. But yeah, I think you're so right about all of that.
And I don't want to put all the responsibility on the pastor either, but I think it is key that, and I hope I have the grace and the time to make it a priority to show interest in individuals that I think might be led in that direction,
yeah.
To have a to spend some time individually with them, and not always running from fire to fire.
Then there's reality.
Then there's reality. But I do that. I try to do that with college students. I ask them to take the initiative to call me, but I ask them. For example, at the door as I'm meeting them, they're going out.
Yeah.
I say, "I would like to have lunch with you. Will you call me this week and I'll take you to lunch?" But
oh, that's great.
Just the reality is that if they don't call me, it probably won't get done. But if they do, it absolutely
right.
will get done.
Yeah.
And that I could focus on them a little bit. But
I think that's wonderful that you would even, if someone would say that to me, even if I didn't call them, I would feel so good. Just because they had said to do that. That's great. Anything else that you can think of? Within the district or the conference, as far as encouraging vocations?
Well, here again, I think if we can invite and take them to some of the places where they can see the connection in operation, that does something. I think beyond their own church experience, I think that does something to have them see how this fits together and how it operates, and to meet some interesting people. And I do that too. Makes an interesting perspective, and it also broadens the perspective.
We've talked around and through this all the way, but what do you feel strongly about women in ministry? What do you feel is the women in ministry are different from men in ministry? What is the great advantage there, or the great gift and grace?
My friend Frank Loewenberg would say that we are the mother. We did a Lenten series that had mothers of different apostles being portrayed, and some in a not very flattering light. But the last week, my friend Mary Hammond had just learned recently that she had lymphoma, and she couldn't do the mother of Jesus, and so I did that last monologue, and throughout it she keeps saying, "I am a mother." And this man, Frank Loewenberg, a retired minister who's dying of cancer, I don't know how many times he's come back and quoted that, said, that's what you are, you're a mother, and you can be that, and a man can't be that, and you can be that. And I think with all the layers of meaning that has, I think that's what we can bring quite easily or naturally, a lot of us. I think, to generalize grossly, that we are perhaps not as much in the ladder climbing competitive arena as some of our male colleagues might be, and that helps us, just helps us be about the business of being where we are and focusing where we are and letting that and having that be enough. And having that be ministering, being fully present where we are and not wondering how this leads to that or where I'll be by this age. And that kind of language is so funny to me. It's so funny to me. And I think that's because I'm a woman. this one person that I dearly love was articulating to me why it was that I should come to this church. It all was based on, well, because if you're 40 now and you're at this level, then by 50 you'll be here. But if you're at this level, then you'll be, you know, I was thinking, wait a minute, what do they need at Oberlin that I have to bring? What
yeah.
in the world does this have to do with,
yeah.
with where, right. where I am when I'm 50 or
right.
60? But it's just a different way of thinking. And I think generally
that's
women
very perceptive.
Are not as
yeah.
into that thing as much.
Mm-hmm.
And as I talk to other women, they
yeah.
seem to know the meaning of being in a small, isolated church that needs this from them and
mm-hmm.
wherever it is. I'm not, you know, as soon as I say that, I realize there are others that are saying, well, we got to fight to get the big churches and all this. But again, maybe it's because I've been fortunate and gotten good appointments. So maybe it's not an issue for me. I don't think it would be, though. I remember just like Judy Craig, who says, I want to finish out, if she's still feeling that way, finish out this second quadrennium in Ohio, and then I'll still be young enough to come back and serve a church. I don't think that's a male way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
You don't go from being a bishop to serving a church. That's going backwards. But no, that's
yes.
where her heart is.
Yes,
and she
that's
was
right.
willing to serve,
yes.
but that's where her...
Oh, yeah. Well, someone that we both know very well, who is, I think, a wonderful pastor, says, oh, I hope they never take me out of a small country church. Mm-hmm. And I can really understand that. Well, it's just sort of like one of the things I've always said about the way we appoint district superintendents. And you take a good pastor and make him an administrator. I mean, is this the Peter principle at work or what? And this is a reward. But for some people, like you say, their goal is to become a district superintendent. And as far as I'm concerned, those are the kind who should not be. Oh, well. Anything else you want to say for the good of the company? Anything on your mind that about your vocation or life?
No, I'm just, as you ask that, I'm just reflecting on who you have been, not only to me, but to Epworth Euclid and to all the churches and the conference that you serve. And it reminds me of something another woman, clergywoman, in fact, said to me very early in my journey when I was a U.S. 2 domestic missioner, and I forget what the context was, except that she pointed out to me that I was apologizing as if I were not a real one because I was a layperson in full-time Christian service, and I had not been aware of it, but she pointed out to me that I was not taking myself seriously, that I needed to take myself seriously, that I was a minister.
Yes.
And you certainly are, and I appreciate your ministry. Just when you were talking about doing the liturgy, I went, oh, yes, how many churches have Mary Bell Landrum who will do the weekly liturgy?
Craziness. Well, that's one reason
yes.
why the new baptismal renewal service is so important to me. And I think it should be important in every church where we recognize that everyone is a minister. Yes. Well, I try. That's all we can do, I guess. Thank you very much. This was great.